Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Augusto Macellari, and Marcus Hippie.
On today's programme, we'll be heading to the Big Apple to meet Retromaniac and Rocco Ariel Pink.
Then we'll be asking what role art plays in helping us to process the world in an age of dizzying technological development with artist Doug Aitken.
And we'll be meeting film curator Hyung-Chin Cho to delve into the history of Korean cinema in advance of the London Korean Film Festival.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news, and we'll have some music that's still to come on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Well, Augustine, we haven't done this before, have we?
I don't think we have, Marcus.
How exciting. 60 minutes of interesting stories and discussions ahead. What are you looking forward to the most?
Probably my interview with Doug Aitken. No, I jest. We've got an excellent, excellent report from Henry Rees Sheridan. Regular listeners might remember him as a sometime producer, now commentator from New York, who does a lot of work with us at Monocle. Do you remember Henry?
I do remember Henry rather well. It's sad that we lost him for New York, but I guess that's the way life goes. On a more positive note, it's been quite an exciting week here at Midori House. I know that you've been enjoying your culture, haven't you?
I went to see a couple of exhibitions, including one by William Blake, who art fans and poetry fans might remember his iconic Tiger Tiger poem standing out among the verses of England, really. Weird pictures of the devil and hell. What I noticed, though, they're all very small, Marcus. It's quite difficult to engage with an exhibition of very, very small pictures.
One example of when size actually does matter. Well, Augustine, what I've been up to, I've been really inspired by this Australian chef I caught up with some days ago, Josh Nyland. He's from Sydney, and he's released a book on preparing the whole fish. You know, there's been a lot of talk about nose to tail cooking, how you shouldn't waste any bits in an animal when you're preparing food, and you can apply that approach to fish as well. So I interviewed Josh. We'll be hearing that interview later on the menu, but this afternoon I thought I would go and buy a whole fish and then prepare something nice from the guts, bones and eyes, something I've never done before because I'm not a great chef in the end. I'm more of a minced meat man.
A Sunday chefer.
Exactly. Would you like to come for a dinner in the evening?
Very much. I'd like to eat some scales and a fish fin.
That's a deal. Should we continue with what's happening in the next 7 days, though?
Let's do it. Let's look ahead to next week. Who's here to do it with us?
Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Welcome.
Hello, guys. Will you invite me for dinner as well, by the way?
You have to ask Marcus about that.
Can I, Marcus?
I always thought you're quite picky with what you eat.
I am, but I never tasted your cooking, so I'm curious now. Even though I would avoid the brain and the guts.
That completely defeats the whole purpose.
Well, I can get you your own fish fillet for this evening. But what's happening in the upcoming 7 days? What's in the news agenda?
Well, my first story actually happens today. Today is the Bolivian election. And the interesting story here is because Evo Morales is trying for his fourth term. But that's the first time that I think he really has a competitor, which is Carlos Mesa. So a lot of people are saying that the election might go for a runoff in December. And Evo Morales is an interesting case as well, because even though he's a left-wing president, I mean, he always had very good relationships with the business communities. He's been a fairly popular president. Even though Bolivia remains like the poorest country in South America, they improved so much when it comes to GDP, less poverty. But there are trouble ahead. I think he didn't dealt very well with recent forest fires in the country. A lot of people start criticizing him. And even people from the left are saying, you know what, he undermined democracy a little bit because he's trying for his fourth term. That's quite a lot.
Exactly. So it wasn't just only Brazil that was having a hard time with the forest fires. Mm-mm. Many, many other countries too.
Bolivia had a terrible, terrible fires. I mean, there's been such a devastation to nature, certain indigenous communities as well. So it's quite a sad story. And perhaps could be the downfall of Evo Morales. It's difficult predicting because the election is today. Maybe we're not going to have a clear result because, as I said, the election might go for a runoff.
Interesting. There's definitely a lot to watch coming out of Latin America at the moment, isn't there? Faye, what have you got next?
Well, stay in the Americas, but more to the north. Tomorrow, is the 21st of October, is the Canadian election. It's interesting, by the way. Canadians vote on Mondays. I think it's the first country to come across the votes on Monday.
I can't name many others either. That's interesting.
In Finland, Thursday, isn't it?
In Finland, it's always Sundays.
In Brazil, it's Sundays as well. I guess they do things differently. And
I would hate to vote on a Sunday.
Why?
Because I want to be at home eating a big steaming bowl of fish guts.
You want to have your excuse to escape job for a couple of hours to go and vote.
You've got my number. Go on, Faye.
But again, Canadian election is difficult to predict. But, you know, I think Justin Trudeau will kind of hang on as the leader, but definitely with not a clear majority as he had last time. But I think the thing is, I was talking even to Daniel, our Canadian colleague, I think the parliament will be more fragmented this time. He might have to do a coalition, which is not a new thing in Canadian politics. And the leader of the opposition, of course, Justin Trudeau had a few scandals with the oil pipe. There's been quite a lot of controversy as well. But the leader of the Conservative Party apparently is quite a dull guy, you know, not very inspiring. So let's see. The Green Party's apparently will do well. We'll have to wait and see, but my prediction is that Justin Trudeau will remain Prime Minister by a smaller margin than last time.
Well, I'm wondering if there's anything happening in the next 7 days that's not election-related, Fernando.
There is one, and actually it's tomorrow as well, so if you're not interested in the Canadian elections, why don't you come to the O2 Arena here in London with me?
What's happening there?
Cher will be performing.
Are you going to go there?
I am going to go, and she's a legend. There are a few legends today in the music world. She's a legend. I've never seen her. I'll be there. It's the Here We Go Again tour. You know the song that we played before my segment here, Fernando? She did re-record that song, and she will perform it, because I did check the set list before.
I've got so many Cher-related memories, one of them being when I was very young and I went on this booze cruise from Helsinki to Stockholm, and there was a disco on board that boat, and the DJ would only play different remixes of the Cher song Believe.
I think we better just knock that anecdote on the head. This is a family show, Marcus. We don't want to know where that's going to end up going, that story, do we?
Just in my room on board that boat.
How long was Believe at the top of the charts for? I feel like it was 12 weeks or something ridiculous in the UK.
It was ages. It broke so many records. Mm. And again, it was kind of a resurgence for Cher. I think she was about 50 at the time, even though we don't talk about age when it comes to Cher. She doesn't have age.
Timeless.
She's timeless.
What's your favorite Cher song?
Oh, God, maybe the Shoop Shoop song. It's a classic. It's easy. It's just... Oh, I Got You, Babe, as well. Sorry, guys, I chose two.
Yeah, that's fine. Is that not with Sunny, too?
Yeah. She would perform that on the show.
Is this sold out?
Probably. I hope so.
Good. A shame that we can't join you. Faye, thanks so much for joining us to take a look at next week. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. You're at home. In a moment, we'll be hearing from the cult art rocker, Ariel Pink. Don't go away. In 2004, the record label Poor Tracks put out an album called The Doldrums by Ariel Pink's Haunted Graffiti. For most people, it was their first encounter with the warped and prolific musical imagination of Ariel Pink, which would go on to have a huge influence on indie music.
But Pink, who was born Ariel Rosenberg, had been recording music ceaselessly since 1996. Hundreds of songs, some of which made it onto self-released cassette tapes and CDs.
Now the Brooklyn label Mexican Summer is putting out reissues of the Ariel Pink albums that Rosenberg recorded and released in obscurity between 1999 and 2004. Monocle's inimitable Henry Reece Sheridan met him at the Mexican Summer Studios in New York. If you stay, you'll have gone all along. Should you stay? I remember reading a quote from you where you said that something which really has shaped your musical sensibility is your earliest memories of music that were formed in kind of the early 80s. And it just struck me that there's as much of a gap between now and the period in which you made those early records as there is between that period and the early 80s.
Quite literally, yeah, it's true.
Have you thought about that at all? Has it made you feel anything?
It makes me think about math. It makes me think about what 20 years means, what it means when being 40 years old and having, sort of like a come to awaken into my current self, more or less, around 20 years ago, and having, you know, basically spent 20 years as a 20-year-old. And then having, you know, when I was 20 years old, being so kind of aware of where I was at 5 years old, and having that inform my creative impetus and all that kind of stuff. And then having my 20-year-old self now sort of dictating my current path. And yeah, I've thought a lot about that and I've, in so many different ways. I still try not to mythologize the importance of any of that stuff.
Between, I think, 1998 and 2004, you recorded an extraordinary amount of music. I think one figure that I've read is over 200 cassettes worth. Is that figure accurate, number one? And number two, why?
Well, I mean, I think it's more than that. Why? I feel like, in hindsight, it was all very much a case of my sort of wanting to be acknowledged and to be heard and to be seen and stuff like that. And I think there was a sort of burning desire that was at the root of all that, you know, and a need for love too. Once you get that stuff, the flame simmers down and you really can actually breathe for a while. And now that I do have a career doing it, it's taken on a different dimension. And perhaps it's not as much of a diaristic enterprise. I don't need to do it all the time to sort of to stake my claim in the universe. I really feel quite sated in my personal life and myself as far as that's concerned. And you know, I feel acknowledged, and I don't feel a burning, desperate urge to mark every single moment of my life with some sort of artistic stamp.
You've called those early recordings kind of like a diary of not only your life at the time, but also the development of your artistic method and your artistic process, basically a diary of you learning to record and make music. When you go back and listen to those early recordings now, is it like reading an old diary, or how you imagine that would be?
I mean, I don't listen back to these songs very much anymore because I know them inside and out. So they've been ingrained in my consciousness, unlike a diary, for instance. It's not like, you know, I just abandoned these things and then just came back 30 years later and read them for the first time. These things are like, they're embedded in me, whether I like it or not. But listening back to them, yeah, I mean, there's a slightly alien quality to it. I mean, I definitely don't know how I did them half the time. Although, unlike diaries, the process of making it is one of endlessly listening back to these things. You know, I mean, like, I mean, each song is a trip into yourself. You know, you go back and you listen to what you recorded previously, and then you basically, like, you know, re-expose yourself to it over and over again. You familiarize yourself with it, and then you stack a new thing on top of it, and then you listen to that, and so the whole process of just like listening back a million times to something, and the goal being that when I'm done with a song, for instance, I mean, I'd want to somehow swipe my memory of it clean, but somehow listen to it as if I've never heard it at all, and see and trying to understand the impression that it would make if I had never heard it before, if I was, you know, listening to it with fresh ears, so to speak. That's the whole sort of conundrum.
Your latest record dedicated to Bobby Jameson. The title refers to Bobby Jameson, who was a singer-songwriter who looked for a moment in the 60s like he was going to become a star, and then for various reasons didn't. And basically many, many years later, resurfaced on the internet with a blog and basically rewrote the history of his life and set the record straight, so to speak, from his perspective.
Wrote the history of his life.
Right. Literally wrote the history.
Like, he wrote himself into the story. It's also a story that's just pretty much the story. I mean, on the far end of it, you have A Star Is Born. You have, you know, the success story. But even then, it comes at a price, and there's also a dip in that arc, or I mean, there's an end to that story. There's a rise and fall. With him, the rise was very, very short-lived, and it was somewhat. It was never really a rise. It was a sense of possibility, and it managed to, like, you know, brush up against things that would come to be very important later on, and canonized, like his brushes with famous people, like Frank Zappa and Rolling Stones and all these things that basically, like, you know, he's got recordings with all these people. He also reminds me of people that I know, lots of artists in LA. He's the story of lots of people who don't really have a story. And so that part I relate to a lot, and I'd like to include myself among those as well, because I don't feel like in any way, shape, or form that I'm going to be remembered or anything like that. I don't think that I have a legacy per se. I think I have a mildly successful career doing what I like.
So having a big chunk of your back catalogue reissued by a record label, and, you know, that generating significant interest, that doesn't give you a sense of having a legacy that has pretty firm foundations. You still feel psychologically vulnerable in spite of that.
I would feel psychologically vulnerable if I were to be reliant on that as being something that I thought was fixed, or, like, you know, that it was like, I mean, it's not. It's no more. It's flimsy just as much as it ever was, and in fact, it's more flimsy because I'm not. Those are past. Those are things that, like, you know, I already did. They have nothing to do with the future. They have nothing to do with where I'm going. I don't want to rest on my laurels, and this is resting on my laurels if I ever was resting on them. It's not like even like a recent record or anything like that. But either way, I mean, I'm proud of what I did. I don't go to music to sort of to get myself my value. You know, I don't know if you. I don't even really go. It's not even artistic pursuits that really define me anymore. I mean, I have a different metric for what brings fulfillment to me in my life. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, what's the metric? Is it creative at all, or is it anything to do with work?
At this point, a little bit, maybe. A lot less, I would say. For me, it's time, it's free time, it's what I'm interested in pursuing that, and I think it has more to do with, it's less to do with me, and it's more to do with my relationship with others. So, it's kind of a personal thing, it's a private thing, but it's definitely not about me being fulfilled so much as, like, you know, having something to share with others and something to that, you know, I feel like I'm easy to please in my own life. I've set the bar pretty low, but I do see myself in relationship to other people now, whereas back then it was really just it was me with myself and that kind of thing. So it's a lot less ego driven, I guess. Even this is like all this time in front of a microphone is just, it actually disturbs me. I don't need to derive a sense of completion or satisfaction from any of these things. This is all illusion. Shaking, body quaking.
Thanks to Ariel Rosenberg, a.k.a. Ariel Pink, and, of course, to Henry Rhys Sheridan as well. You can find details of Mexican Summer's Ariel Archives project at ariel-pink.com. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Augustine, shall we continue with some music?
Yes.
Ariel Pink made waves with his cover of Forgotten 70s Oddity Baby by Donny and Joe Emerson. Let's have a listen to the original.
When we're out in the moonlight, looking up all the stars above, feels so good when I'm near you, holding hands and making love. So baby.
What a spooky and interesting song that was. It spawned multiple covers, might I tell you, Marcus. That was Donny and Jermison with Baby. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
You are listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We've heard from an artist who draws on the past. Let's meet one who reflects on the present now. US-based artist and filmmaker Doug Aitken is known for his bold, epic and often public works. His eclectic practice spans mediums but returns to a central focus, how we look at and inhabit the world around us today, and in doing so how we might imagine a new future.
Doug's latest solo show is on now at Victoria Miro Gallery in London. Entitled Return to the Real, it's an immersive audio-visual exploration of how digital technologies inform our own lives. It urges us to stop, look around, and take stock. I caught up with Doug as he finished installing the show at the gallery to learn more.
The title of the exhibition is Return to the Real, and I think I became very interested in this idea of the separation between screen life and physical life. And I found myself more fascinated by the questions this posed, this kind of idea of moving into a new terrain, a new landscape, which in some ways we don't really know how to navigate. Yeah, I think we're equipped with tools that we barely know how to use, and we're kind of moving into a space which is largely undefined.
It's difficult. Do you see that as one of the kind of key roles of the artist in the 21st century, working out how we navigate these spaces?
Well, I think the value of art is it's a space outside of overt capitalism. It's a space outside of direct function and survival. And I think in many ways it kind of is a space that allows us to question. It allows us to have a discussion. That discussion can be social or it can be internal. You know, without room for that, what is their society?
How do you want your audiences to take it then? I noticed there's mirrors in this exhibition, and you've used mirrors before in other works. I always think it's quite interesting when an artist puts a mirror in a show. Could you reflect, as it were, on that?
No pun intended, of course.
Yeah, sorry about that. I'll be editing that out. A real shame.
It's okay. My mother was a journalist.
Okay.
I think the installation is designed in a way, really, where the viewer can kind of merge with it. They can kind of become part of it. I was very interested in creating something that was not passive, that wasn't simply an image that you look at and consume, but instead something that was spatial, that was perceptual, something that you could really explore both in a material sense, but also a dematerial sense. When I say dematerial, I'm talking about sound. Sound is a huge component to this exhibition. There is two separate compositions which are created almost entirely of human voices, layers of overtones. And they go back to a kind of musical minimalism, taking certain words or phrases, repeating them until they become abstract. They become these kind of soundscapes and washes.
We're also sitting outside in the garden at Victoria Miro. We're looking at this amazing wind chime sound sculpture echoed upstairs They have some sort of mechanism internally, do they, that generates sound at random? I was wondering, because the charm of a wind chime is its randomness, is the way that the harmonics operate according to how they're blown. Upstairs, you have these very beautiful sculptures rotating, they're kinetic sculptures, but which have no flexibility to move. So I wondered where the randomness comes in there, if it does at all.
Well, I think that's a very good question. And that idea, that balance between order and chaos, patterns and asymmetry, for me is very much at the core of a body of work like this. Here you find the soundscape. Sound and Light is the upstairs piece is titled Inside Out. And literally you find this kind of landscape of abstract light, pulses of light and chroma kind of moving through the space. You hear these sounds, patterns of sound, and it almost kind of harkens back to early minimalist music of Terry Riley or Steve Reich, the samples. But at the same time, there's something, I think, within the exhibition which is constantly breaking that, catching you off guard. You fall into a hypnosis, but then something comes out of the corner of your eye, or something comes from behind you. And I was very interested in that idea of really creating almost a set where the viewer is a performer, and the viewer gets pulled into it, and they find that they're eventually occupying the stage, and the film is kind of the film of the mind.
Is that movement in the periphery, that disconcerting quality that maybe makes us wake up and evaluate our surroundings again, do we need that at the moment?
I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, I know this word is very cliche, but the idea of disruption is very essential in many ways. And what I mean by that is, I think if we look at our day to day, we look at our week, our month, our year, it's almost impossible to remember certain passages of time. They're so banal. You know, driving in the taxi, being on the highway, sitting down for a coffee again and again and again. I think a lot of ways when we look back on our personal history, it's these moments of disruption that we record, that we actually reach back and we pull those periods of time or those situations, and they have meaning. We assign meaning to them. And so I think in a lot of ways that also comes back to art itself. Like, why do we value art? What are the artworks that we see as necessary? And, you know, what are the artworks which are kind of beige, that just kind of merge into the background like wallpaper? And for me, that's a huge interest.
Mm. That word disruption has obviously been popularized and then kind of vilified by Facebook and their ethos. Well, Silicon Valley in general. That's an area, an industry that's really complicating our relationship with the screen and with the web. Wasn't that long ago that people, the artists, were thinking about the internet as this hyper-utopian space? You know, a lot of this so-called post-internet art was really wide-eyed, it was really optimistic. And that's kind of changing now. How has that come to inform your relationship with the digital and the way that you want to reflect on it for your audience?
Well, it's interesting you ask that question. There is a simultaneous installation we're creating in London right now, and the title of it is New Era. It's at 180 Strand, a show called Transformer. And New Era is a work which I created where I found myself asking that question, is there a humanity at the source of technology? Is there an inventor, a single person for some of the objects that we can't live without? And in that situation, I found myself literally sitting at a cafe. I looked up and every single human I saw was wiping their phone, speaking on their phone, or looking at messages. And I thought to myself, how did we arrive at this place? And I said, almost a kind of personal reflection, I said, is someone responsible for this? Like, where did it come from? And I found myself then kind of researching the history of the cell phone. And that led me back to this man named Martin Cooper, who in 1973 invented the cell phone and then made the first call in history. And over the process of creating this artwork, we got to know each other. We spent time. I filmed these conversations with him and eventually built a piece, which is not a documentary. It's very much kind of hallucinatory landscape. It's kind of a space between the present and what could be the future. And I found myself really interested in this question, this idea of technology and its role, and is it an extension of us, or does it kind of move beyond us? Do we reach a point where it dictates our moves? It controls our patterns? Or are we always in control and able to break free, which I don't quite think so right now. I think making New Era was a very interesting journey, and I think you were talking earlier about what is the role of an artwork? Can it ask questions? Can it empower the viewer? And with that work, I really wanted that. I wanted the viewer to kind of walk inside the space and start questioning their own condition, reflecting on their own landscape, and using the artwork almost as a tool to kind of put a wedge in this reality that we're surrounded by.
this summer particularly, we've really seen artists and art groups step beyond the questioning, even beyond the criticism, into a sort of activism. Warren Kanda's standing down at the Whitney seemed to me to be a kind of cornerstone, something that will resonate in the future. When we're dealing with these kind of scary forces that aren't entirely harmful, like phones, like people's attachment to them, you know, all of this has been documented in things like the Great Hack, its potential influence on the US election, and so on. Are you ever tempted to, I suppose, become an activist yourself? Or do you still kind of want to be a part and exist in an art environment where you're maybe offering a different, calmer space for reflection than direct action, I suppose?
Well, that's a difficult question and a complex one. I think in many ways, the act of making art is an act of activism. You know, I think you're expressing yourself. You're putting forth an idea or concept. You're proposing something that is open to disagreement. And I think that action is incredibly powerful in our society right now. If you look at the kind of the homogenized capitalist structure that we live in, we need to hear voices of individuals, and we all need to be heard. I think that's kind of one side of the coin. You know, perhaps the other side of the coin that I find personally is the work I make is really, for me, largely driven by questions. It's concepts and questions. And some of these are incredibly personal, things that kind of eat at you over time, and eventually they kind of calcify and solidify into the form of some kind of artwork, some kind of sculpture or object. But at the same time, I've found that recently, in the last several years, more and more I've been doing collaborations with ecological groups. This has not existed before. We did something 2 months ago, and it was called New Horizon. It was a 100-foot flying mirrored sculpture. And with this project, it wasn't with the museum, it wasn't through a gallery. It was the world's oldest land conservation group, the world's oldest land trust group called the Trustees. And they shepherd 100, 150 different locations across the East Coast. And it was interesting to me to have a dialogue with them about creating an artwork. And for them, I think, they said something that for me that was quite provocative. They said, we have all this land from a sprawling sand dune on Martha's Vineyard to a deep forest. But people don't really know how to see it. They don't really know how to interact with it. They see it as kind of anonymous almost. A forest is a forest. Green is green. How do we activate that? How do we turn that into a starting point to see again, to suddenly open your eyes and have a moment where everything is unique and real and it's not mundane? And their answer for that in one way was to work with artists, to create artworks that would perhaps bring you into the landscape in a different way. And this is what we found both with that project and with the underwater pavilions, which we did with Parley for the Oceans, an ocean activist group. And in the same way with issues of the ocean, with, you know, ocean rise, with plastic pollution, with all these topics, they become so kind of generic after a while. They're hard to personalize. They're difficult to humanize, you know. And I think in that situation with the underwater pavilions, we created three sculptures that were under the Pacific Ocean that you literally had to swim or dive into. And this is a bizarre and foreign and for some people uncomfortable proposition to don a wetsuit in December and to push under a kelp bed with a north swell coming out of the Aleutians. And suddenly you find yourself almost weightless, gliding through the ocean floor, and you see these objects in the distance. You approach them, you kind of swim through them and around them, and you find yourself suddenly in this landscape that is completely democratic. That school of Garibaldi that swim by you could care less if you're a human. That dark object in the distance could care less. And to me, that project was so interesting. It was kind of revelatory in a sense, that kind of living in the society where we're fed these false myths of virtual reality and AI and these kind of technological innovations which are going to enhance our reality, I found that being 50 feet under the ocean surface was more shattering to my reality than I could have imagined. Mm.
That's a fascinating proposition. I mean, even just to go back to the idea of the artist as a kind of visual interlocutor between organizations or between landscapes and between people. Do you think that that's something that seems like a future, a positive future? You were a recipient of the Frontier Art Prize, you were the first recipient of it, precisely because of the way that you engage with potential futures. I wanted to ask whether now is quite a complicated time to be doing that. This sort of initiative seems to present quite a hopeful view on how artists and their audiences and third parties can kind of symbiotically move forward.
It's a fascinating and revolutionary time to be alive. And we as a species have never come across a crossroads like this in human history. You know, the rate of acceleration, the sense of connectivity, you know, the idea of flow in terms of cultures. Where does that leave art? Where does that leave art making? On one hand, you know, perhaps for someone to sit down and do a watercolor is a defiant act, to suddenly turn off and to draw. And on the other end of the spectrum, perhaps you could say, where can art go from here? And I can't really answer that, but I can answer that a little bit for myself, for my own beliefs. And I'm very invested in the idea that art should move wider. It should be outside of only a capitalist structure. It should not only be in museums and galleries. It should be on the streets, in the air, in the ocean, in the forest. It should be everywhere and anywhere. It should be material and dematerial. And I think if we really embrace that idea that art is this liquid form that can just transform and exist on any frequency, I think we have more possibilities for new communication.
Thank you. Doug Aitken and anyone in London should get along to see Return to Real at Victoria Miro before it closes on December the 20th.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's the Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in the Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
Now, while London cineasts might be starting to feel a bit jittery as the post-film festival shakes take hold, they mustn't fear, for another one is just around the corner.
The 14th London Korean Film Festival starts on the 1st of November, and this year boasts an extraordinary array of the best of a century of Korean cinema. Augustine, you sat down with the festival's director, Hyung Jin Cho, to hear more about how Korean films have found popularity in the West. Jin started by explaining how the festival began.
The London Korean Film Festival is kind of unique, I would say, in a sense that it's really trying to show the sheer diversity of Korean cinema from, of course, the well-known blockbusters, but also to archival titles, to artist moving image, to militant documentary. So some other film festivals in the UK do show some Korean films as part of their program, but the amount of sort of diversity that the LKFF brings is, I would say, is very unique. And we try to really keep that as our main principle.
How did it come about? It's the 14th iteration of the film festival. Obviously, Korea has a really rich cinema history, but when was it seen that there was a gap for that kind of thing in London?
I would say the international recognition of Korean cinema kicked off with Old Boy when that won the Grand Prix at Cannes Film Festival in 2004. Of course, some of the classic films were presented in different film festivals as part of a classic strands, but that was a key moment. And I think the London at the time didn't have any presentation of Korean cinema, at least dedicated to Korean cinema. So Ministry of Korean Culture did start to have a film festival that would dedicate to the Korean cinema. But it was a very small festival when we started. We had like 10 titles, and now we show 60 titles. So it grew every year.
I'm really interested that you mentioned Old Boy there. I also had written down a few other films, The Host and more recently The Handmaiden, that have all served to really raise the profile of Korean cinema in the West. How has that expansion of Korean cinema's market started to change it? You mentioned that it maybe could be tracked back to Old Boy. Has that awareness of Western audiences become something that Korean filmmakers are starting to engage with?
I think that's actually the big question. I think we can probably talk about it for an hour. But to say very briefly, I think it's a mixture of Korean film directors who, you know, has this amazing awareness of what's going on in world cinema. But at the same time, some of these very successful Korean titles, I would say, are very culturally specific. Even the, you know, Parasite, which won Palme d'Or this year, the Bong Joon-ho did say that he was very surprised by this reception by the foreign audiences, because he kind of wanted to make this film that make Korean audiences to giggle. There's so many humors and so many deep jokes, you can only play with the language. But he was very surprised. So I wouldn't say these directors like make films specifically to sort of target this foreign, you know, international film festivals. But somehow the richness, and because Korea in the last half a century, Korea went through so much politically, socially, because society itself is very complex and kind of has a very like challenging issues that it's dealing with. It has a very strong kind of protest culture. At the same time, we had a most, you know, horrendous oppressive regime. So the society itself is very complex, and the film is a reflection of that. And I think a lot of people overseas can relate to it, and, you know, the power of that, the reality comes through, I think, in cinemas.
Mm. I'm interested to pick that up because, you know, obviously cinema from any country kind of reflects some of the cultural concerns that are going on in that place. I feel like Hollywood has started to metabolize the fallout of the Me Too movement with recent releases. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood seemed to deal fairly implicitly with, you know, the role of the male filmmaker and all of these questions. Obviously, Korea has got this very fraught history across the 20th century, but I wondered, in contemporary Korean cinema, what you can pick out. Where can we take the temperature of Korean culture through looking at its contemporary cinema and seeing what it's engaging with?
I think it's very difficult to kind of just say a key theme, I would say. But I think, unlike many other sort of national cinemas, the Korean cinema does deal with this contemporary world we live in. We no longer have this very, at least in the case of Korea, very clear enemy we are fighting against. It's sort of all the residue of late capitalism. The society is deeply, you know, in a way, sick. It's a lot of people are suffering, but we don't exactly know where that's coming from. It's so, I think Parasite, you know, and the gap, the economic gap, disparity, it just this something that is kind of ghostly presence. Mm. That we can't really know. So in the 80s and 90s, there are a lot of films that had a direct kind of commentary on the problems that the society had, you know, i.e. dictatorship, very censorship, oppressive regime, etc. But now Korea seems to be wealthy on the surface, and it doesn't seem to have this very, again, clear sort of enemy we're fighting against. But there are this kind of ghostly presence. So Parasite, for example, I think is dealing with this issue in a very clever way. And a lot of Korean films, I would say a lot of indie titles, which KF have tried to present as much as possible, do deal with these social issues in a very subtle way. The title we showed last year as an opening title, called Microhabitat, did deal with this woman, 30-year-old woman, trying to find a place to live in. Seoul is an expensive place. It's not easy to pay your rent at the same time, pursue your interest, in our case, a musician. So, yeah, we do have a lot of indie titles that does deal with those issues, if that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just on Parasite briefly, it seems like Bong Joon-ho, you know, he's arguably had the most global success. It seems to me, you know, he's crossed over into Western cinema. He directed Snowpiercer, he directed Okja, which was a huge hit for Netflix. What's happening in the other direction? Are there any Western directors who are, you know, American or British, who are making films that really resonate with a Korean audience at the moment?
I think that's a very difficult question for me to answer because I haven't lived in Korea for, you know, the past 20 years. So it's something that, I mean, I kind of read about it, but it's not something I kind of experience. So it's a difficult one. But I do hear that Kingsman did really well in Korea, just, you know, in terms of box office. I can maybe say something about certain, like, cultural exchange, not at the moment, but what's been happening maybe since the 1960s, because we do show a lot of classic titles this year because it's the 100th anniversary of birth of Korean cinema. And a lot of directors I spoke to and I read about, the directors from the 1950s and 60s and 70s, they did speak about the influence they had from Italian neo-realist filmmakers, De Sica, Fellini, etc. So even from, you know, early on, there was a cultural exchange, and also there was a very, I mean, direct engagement between Korea and Japan as well. So there were a lot of co-productions during the Japanese colonial era, as well as after the kind of Korean War. So I think the kind of cultural exchange always existed.
As you say, it's the 100th anniversary of Korean cinema as a kind of institution, as a body. It must have been difficult to program this year's festival. Suddenly you have this richness of cinematic history. What were the conversations that were happening around that? What were you kind of trying to draw out? Were you going, obviously, not just for the Gone with the Winds and things like that? How did you navigate it?
Yes, it was a challenge, but it was, for me, it was a really delightful experience. We had literally 1,000 films to choose from. We, in the end, chose 26 titles that's part of a classic strand. Instead of just picking the hits, we tried to pick films that had a resonance with the times when that was made, but also with perhaps now. So certain issues, after we picked all the films, we thought about the older titles we picked, and we could kind of group them under, I don't know, five, six sort of mini strands under the titles such as War, Social Change, Woman's Representation, Shamanism and Religion, etc. So, yeah, we sort of try to pick the titles. Also, we also want, because they are films and how they are represented in cinema is something that's very important. So we try to pick titles that were recently restored. Also, some titles that have a very beautiful 35mm print that we can project. So it was a mixture of these thinkings that went through.
That sounds like it must also have been an education for you, you know, setting out with these themes, kind of seeing what you could find. Were you surprised to track developments across the decades in certain fields like women's representation?
Yes, I've done some research, not just this year. I've been studying this the past probably 5-6 years. So I was aware of a lot of these key works, probably from 1960s, which is considered as the golden age of Korean cinema. But I was quite surprised by some of the works from late 1950s, right after Korean War, the completeness and the masterful storytelling in these films right after the war. And because it was maybe post-war, there wasn't any very strong kind of a social structure, like, you know, in terms of we were constantly, you know, changing the government, etc. So actually, how women were at the time came across to me as very, like, strong kind of individual. They were strong survivors. You know, they had to kind of work as hard as men in order to survive. So they weren't just kind of these beautifully kept housewives, which we begin kind of to see a little bit like late 80s and 90s, after 20 years of the military regime. You see so this role of women becoming actually much more kind of regressed, so surprisingly. So yeah, there are those works like The Flower in Hell, one of the key works by director Shin Sang-ok, which I found it really amazing. And then I want to talk about some of the films from the 1960s by Lee Man-hee. He died very young, but he made like 50 films. So he's one of the prolific directors from the 60s. He made this film called A Day Off and Homebound, which we are showing at the festival. They both are as contemporary as any films that you will see now, this, you know, young couple struggling to basically survive, but without the mobile phones and, you know, without the CG. So it's a really shared, each scene is just so spectacular, and we are very happy to show the 4K restoration of these works.
That sounds really essential, and you've just given me a little insight there. But just to close, I know it's always difficult. What are your highlights from this festival, if you can pick any out?
I would go back to what I just said. Some of the key works from the 1960s, they're just amazing. They're just masterpieces. You can compare that with Antonioni. It's just beautiful. So the three works by Imani, A Day Off, Homebound, and The Devil's Stairway is something I wouldn't miss. Another film from 1961 called Aimless Bullet, which is perhaps his most celebrated Korean film alongside Housemaid from 1960, Kim Gi-young's 1960 film. Those works I would recommend it highly enough. But we are also, this year, we are very happy and honored to bring this director, Kim Soo-young, who's made 109 films. And he's probably made most films starting from 1958. And we are opening the festival with his film, The Seashore Village. And we are showing another film by him called Bloodline. So both films are realist films, and the Seashore Village being really about the community of female widows living in a very small sea town, and Bloodline set in post-war Seoul, in a shanty area of Seoul, and all these people who make kind of amazing social life are all the North Korean refugees. And I would say this is kind of equivalent to Mike Lee's film. It's a very stark and yet very humorous and very warm. And he will be here. He's 90 years old. He's coming here to talk to the audience. So, yeah, it will be a really rare opportunity not to be missed.
That sounds fantastic. And as you say, all of these films for the connoisseurs, but also as resonant now as they were when they were made, so not to be missed by any film fans. Jin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My thanks to Hyungjin Cho. And the festival runs in London from the 1st to the 14th of November, a couple of weeks of excellent Korean cinema. Head to koreanfilm.co.uk for more information on the programme and, crucially, to book tickets. Don't miss out on those. You're with the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Marcus, what a lovely pleasure it was. Before we rush away to feast on the intestines of some subaquatic creature.
Exactly. As I promised in the beginning of this program, we are going to be eating a lot of seafood, whole fish for dinner.
Let us reflect before we go to do that on what's transpired here.
Well, I think I'm very inspired now by Korean cinema. I think I have to go and start booking tickets to see what's happening in the film industry in Seoul. It was also really good to hear from Ariel Pink, an artist I didn't know that well before.
You a fan?
I think I am now, yeah.
You can revisit his entire extensive back catalogue. We better leave it though. We've got fish to go and eat whole. Wait, you do cook them, don't you?
I do cook them.
Okay.
I do cook them.
Not raw. That's it for edition 537 of The Monocle Weekly. I produced today's show and our studio manager was Mae Lee Evans.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Marcus Hippie.
And from me, Augustin Macellari.